The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 4th of May, 2021. On the podcast today, Tony Sirichik, CEO of Salt Lake Potash, talks about the significant progress they're making towards first SOP sales in the June quarter and positive cash flow thereafter. Also, Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent and now the author of The Crypto Trader, covers this week's all-time high in Ethereum, rougher selling Bitcoin, and the red flag surrounding Hyperfund. And, as always, at the end of the podcast, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most read RNSs too. By the way, you can see both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, and in fact, there's lots of other content there. In fact, there's one there on Blencow Resources initiates second stage of drilling at Orem Cross. That is also Tech Capital. Guidant introduces control software for autonomous vehicles. Intelligent Ultrasound launched ScanNav in UK market. There's also, in fact, the podcast did earlier there, but COVID-19, let's have a look at that index right now. What's the biggest riser? Biggest rise is Hemogenics Pharmaceuticals, up 10% to 2.9. It's had a bit of a fall of recent. In fact, one of my stocks is second. It's Gfinity, up 5% to 5.15, breaking that 5p resistance. Will it last? Who knows? In the long term, it will. And biggest faller, Dev Clever Holdings, down 11% to 26.25. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Tony Sirichik, Chief Executive Officer of Salt Lake Potash. SO4 is a ticker there. Tony, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me back, Justin.
Yeah, I always like to go on the on your Twitter feed to look at your, you know, the pictures there. And is either someone very tall taking those pictures, or you've got some kind of drone going on? What is that, Tony?
No, I am a bit of a fan of the pictures. We have drones up in the sky. They go up every day. We use them for particularly for monitoring progress, also for looking over the operation. It covers such a vast spread geographically. We use drones for borefield inspections and trench inspections, and sure do capture a few happy snaps on the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, listen, you got a bit of news out last week or so. You've had environmental news and a quarterly update. We'll get into that. But as always, you know, if someone's listening right now and not familiar with the company, can you just summarise what you're about, please, Tony?
Yeah, look, Salt Lake Potash, or SO4 as we're known, we're a pending or just about to be a producer of premium potash fertiliser. That's developed from an aquifer brine solar evaporation process here in the goldfields in Western Australia. Our first project is Lake Way, and it's just outside a township called Wiluna in Western Australia. And what's quite unique about this company is the portfolio of lakes that we have that will support a growth vision as we go forward, developing multiple lakes to grow that production of sulfate of potash over the years to come.
Yeah, absolutely. And last week, explain this. So you had a grant of environmental permit. What is that about, and what's the significance of that, Tony?
Yeah, look, we took a unique approach or strategy to the permitting approvals process for this project, really to support the speed with which we have executed the development of this first lake. And what we did there is we went through a three-stage, construction slash approvals program, and we've just finalised or received the final approval from the EPA and the government, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the government sign off on what we call here at the Part 4 approval. That basically puts us in the all clear from an environmental perspective and allows us to now just execute the final stage 3, which simply is replication of more ponds on the lake and more trenches on the lake to abstract brine to put in those ponds. It's a few months' work, 3 months' work ahead of us. You know, the gear's on site, the people are on site, and we are actually already executing against that program.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's go into the quarterly report. It's just for the end of the 31st of March. Let's go through so operations so far. So where are you at with the operations?
Yeah, look, the quarterly report's a solid one. What was in that was basically construction progress. We have not been doing much on lake in terms of solar evaporation ponds and brine trenches. Now we will with the receipt of that approval last week. What we have been doing is putting bores into the aquifer, shallow bores, 100-metre bores to extract brine out into those trenches, and also moving ahead very fast on the process plant construction development. At the end of the March quarter, the process plant was 97% complete on an as-earned basis. And the numbers are in there. Our engineering and procurement are done. They're 99%. There's just some little rats and mice to be completed at the end. Construction is 99.0% complete at the end of the March quarter. So, and that was a month ago, more than a month ago, 5 weeks ago. So we are, we're well up in the high 90% complete now. We have full commissioning teams on site. We've had them there for several weeks now. Our operations team is fully mobilised on site. Commissioning of that plant is well over 50% done now. We've always been guiding first production in the June quarter. We are squarely in the middle of that June quarter now, and we are just weeks away from commencing what we call load commissioning or wet commissioning and the production of SOP at the back end.
Yeah. One thing that's, I looked at there, you've unveiled the product suite. Explain this if you could.
Yeah, well, that's what comes out the back end. We have unveiled a three-product suite there, and we've cutely called them SOP, which is obviously sulfate of potash. SOP Precision is our water-soluble, our very premium grade. They're all high potassium, high K content, and all have low chloride contents. The uniqueness with the SOP Precision is the water solubility. It can be used in the very high-end cash cropping, water system fertigation agricultural areas. Then we have, that's going to be the first product we produce alongside what we have called SOP Prime, which is basically standard powder. So they're the first two products we will be making. We will have a differentiated water-soluble Precision and also an SOP Prime, which is the standard powder. It'll also be it'll also have a low chloride, high K content as well, but will not be as water-soluble as the Precision product. The third product is SOP Premium. You can tell we all like our peas. And that is the granular product that will be about a year away. We're guiding fiscal year 23. We'll have our granulation, our first module there on site operating, and we'll be able to service that part of the market as well. So the three products are there, and two of those three will be hitting the market in the weeks to come.
I know a lot of it's pre-sold, but how is the market for SOP then?
Oh, look, the market's very hot, Justin, and I don't need to oversell it. This COVID, this food security, there's government focus in that area. People only have to look at, the likes of soy, corn, wheat. All of those commodity prices are surging, have been for a few months now, 6 months plus, and that with that follows, a surge in fertilizer demand and then pricing as well. I mean, farmers are getting more money from their crops and products, and then they go apply more love to the land, and through that they acquire more fertilizer, and that drives up demand and pushes prices up, and we've seen exactly that happening.
And so you're confident now starting to produce cash sales in this quarter, yeah?
Yeah, that's right, Justin. I mean, we're not allergic to making cash. That is the focus. We want to become cash flow positive as quickly as we can. Look, we'll be going through a period of commissioning, through that June, July months, and obviously tuning different parts of the plant, and there will be a variable component of product coming out of the back end. We are talking to several domestic, very local farmers to take that commissioning product, and there's a huge amount of interest that's coming in the doors at the moment for that product. And then once we've settled down a reliable, consistent, good quality product, that's when we'll be hitting our off-takers to go into the global market.
Excellent stuff. Okay, Tony, as always then, three reasons. If someone's liking the sound of what you're doing here, the progress you're making, but are not yet following the story, give them three reasons why they should hit that button on your page on Salt Lake Potash and add you to their watch list, please.
As always, Justin, they're my three T's. And the first T is thematic. I mean, this has a lovely thematic. It's got some beautiful tailwinds behind it. We've got growing populations. We've got, you know, shifting demands and wants, growing middle classes that want, you know, improved diets. Mm-hmm. With all that, you know, comes a demand, you know, for more product. And what we know is a declining land base. So they need more product off less land to meet more demanding people's wants. So it has a wonderful thematic, not to mention the clean green element of a, you know, a solar evaporation brine fertilizer production unit. It's basically salt water and sunshine making fertilizer to feed people. So a lovely thematic behind this project. That's the first T. The second T is technical. We've had the fortunate luck of being smothered in existing infrastructure around this project, which was a huge reason why myself and the team, you know, focused on it and took this on, knowing we could move this along fast. We've got, you know, basically a gas line to the eastern edge of the lake. We've got a goldfields highway existing on the western edge of the lake. We've got a township airstrip on the northern edge of the lake and the Wiluna Township just north of us. So, you know, all of that existing infrastructure is really supportive and it's low capex and supportive of a fast pathway schedule. Technically as well, you know, in terms of grade, it's the highest grade SOP lake in the whole goldfields of all the players. So we're fortunate enough to be in the development of the highest grade lake as our first project. So my second T is technical. And third T is team. A couple of years ago, and I amassed an incredibly experienced team to come and deliver this project with me. Everyone, you know, has pushed on, pushed hard. You know, the team's got thousands of hours of construction, commissioning, ramp up, and operations maintenance experience. And I think I'm biased in my opinion, but I'd go to say for a market cap our size, it'd be one of the best teams I've ever seen globally. So that's my third T, team. So it's thematics, technical, and team. Three
days. Excellent stuff, Tony. Good to chat to you as always, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Plenty of good news to come. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman, and he is an author. He was a previous business correspondent on ITV. He made lots of money. Did you, Glenn, doing some crash or something?
Yeah, so much money, dude.
What did you do? You shorted something? What did you short there?
Yeah, that's right. It was in 2008, and I shorted pretty much the whole market, but particularly the banking stocks.
How did you short the whole market?
Shorting indices, okay. Like the S&P 500.
Yeah.
So it was mainly the American market that I was shorting because that was the one where the subprime crash was going on.
I got you.
So that was when I slightly famously turned £3,000 into £100,000.
Okay.
That was my claim. Wrote about in the Times.
Yeah, shorting can be a bit risky though, can't it?
Yes, shorting can be risky. Shorting is very risky. Have we talked about this before? Am I having a deja vu here?
No.
Oh, no, it's right. It's because I wrote an article about it recently.
Yeah.
I'm having a bit of a deja vu. So, yeah. Okay. Shorting is dangerous for the following reasons. Number one, when you get a large decline, it tends to be followed by an almost equally large reaction upwards. So it's very easy to lose all your profits immediately after making huge profits on a plunge. The market tends to be incredibly volatile and then recover enormously. So shorting successfully involves impeccable timing, which, as we all know, is incredibly difficult to pull off, even for professionals. And the other reason that shorting is not a great idea and why I do it rarely is because, if you think about it, the upside when you're going long is thousands of percentage points or theoretically infinity. So, you know, that's how you make most of your money, Justin, is on like small stocks that are long shots, but you get the occasional 10 bagger or whatever. Whereas with shorting, the absolute maximum that you can make is 100%. Mm-hmm. And that's if the share goes to zero, which obviously doesn't happen very often. So the mathematics are heavily against shorting. So it's not something I do often, but in 2008, the opportunity was too good to miss. But that doesn't come along very often.
No. I suppose then, like anything, you've got to be assured there's a trend going on there, isn't there? I mean, there's a strong trend you thought already happening there, selling. You know, just go counter trend. Because if you go counter trend, especially in shorting, you could be in big trouble. Like I said, if you try to short Bitcoin, you may have had a couple of successes over the last few years, but let's be honest, the trend has been very strong in Bitcoin's favour. So it's the wrong. It's like swimming against the tide, isn't it? You've got to go with the tide anyway, either way you go.
Yeah, you know? There's been a lot of liquidations in because I follow and I trade Bitcoin futures, where you can go long or short. You use leverage. Which in itself is dangerous because you're borrowing money in order to trade. So I'm very careful with my leverage. I tend to take much smaller position sizes in order not to find myself in deep trouble. Smaller position sizes compared to if I was trading spot prices, i.e. not using leverage. So anyway, the point is that a lot of people get liquidated on these Bitcoin and crypto futures platforms. And what that means is you've got an account, you've got a certain amount of money in the account, you use leverage, say buy Bitcoin, and you use leverage. So you're taking, people take on big positions, and they might say they've only got $5,000 in their account, and they take a Bitcoin position that by borrowing money is a $50,000 Bitcoin position or a $100,000 Bitcoin position, right? And all that takes is for Bitcoin to just fall a tiny bit, you know, and Bitcoin is very volatile. All it needs to do is fall by a few percent and their $5,000 in their account is completely wiped out. And that's when their trade is liquidated. The platform automatically closes the position and they lose all their money. And that happens to thousands of people all the time, like every few days.
I'm surprised they're allowed people, you know, who are not what they call sophisticated investors to get involved in that. Why'd they allow that? I mean, a leverage position. Because, like I said, people go into these things just looking at the upside, not understanding it get wiped out quite nastily, you know, if it gets it wrong, don't they, you know?
Well, the British regulator, the FCA, has brought in a rule at the beginning of this year that crypto derivative trading, that platforms aren't allowed to market crypto derivatives to UK investors. And any platforms that are seen to be openly encouraging British investors or British traders to do that kind of thing are going to get in trouble. And some of them have already been eyed by the FCA.
Eyed.
they've been noticed, shall we say. Yeah. But that's for retail traders. The rule was just for retail traders, so-called professional traders, people who qualify
lose
as
money
professionals.
For living.
Yeah, basically. they are allowed to, people like me, basically, are allowed to continue doing, you have to pass certain,
but I did
certain
that. No,
standards.
I did, but
you have to have a certain amount of money and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, but I set up, a balance account recently, and I'm sure the leverage was open to me as well.
What was it on? What kind of platform?
Binance.
Oh, right. Yes. That's because Binance is not regulated in the UK for a start.
Oh, okay. Right.
It's based, nobody knows where. That's the crazy thing. It's the biggest crypto trading platform in the entire world, and yet it doesn't even have a set headquarters that anybody can pinpoint. That's how Wild West this world of crypto is. But nonetheless, yeah, any British retail trader can go on to Binance and open an account and trade using leverage. But Binance's argument, I assume, would be that they don't actively market their leverage products to UK traders. So if you go there and do it off your own back, that's your business. I don't know. It's a grey area. It's a murky area.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get on to the volatility of Bitcoin. And you mentioned last week you did a chart where you looked at comparing Bitcoin against Ethereum, and rather than against USD, and you were saying there was strength on the Ethereum side.
Yes, there was a lot of strength. Basically, what we were talking about last week was the ETH/BTC chart, i.e., Ethereum against Bitcoin. And when you look at the chart of Ethereum against Bitcoin, you see that it was ready to make a big breakout. In fact, what date were we talking last week? That would have been the 27th. And yeah, that's right. I was talking about how it was just looking like it was just starting to break out. And indeed it has. It broke out of that huge multi-year resistance line and has done incredibly well. It's all in the press this past week, that not the ETH BTC chart, but the fact that Ethereum is doing so well.
An all-time high.
Yeah,
well, it did yesterday, but now it's just having a breathe a little bit. In fact, as I'm looking, all
so as I said last week, I'm in Ethereum, and because of that, because of the ETH BTC thing, that was what was exciting me.
Yeah, well, as an analogy, I try to explain difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum to friends on the weekend podcast, and I said Bitcoin is like the first computer, essentially. Wow, it was amazing, and then. You realise you get another computer and you put a network in there and you think, that's Ethereum, really, the start of the internet. You know, it's almost you can build stuff on it. So that, to me, is more valuable because anyone can sort of, build computers. But if you're building, decentralised apps and they use Ethereum, then surely the value's in Ethereum, isn't it? Because no one knows what Bitcoin's there for, really. Store of value. It's an asset, yes, but is that's it? It's an appreciated asset.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I've thought this for... Well, I've thought this for a long time. I wrote in my book, hold on, there's a paragraph. Here it is. I was talking about Bitcoin in my book, which the book I wrote about 2 years ago now, and I say, but then came Ethereum, because it's like when Bitcoin came along, I was interested, but I wasn't sort of absolutely fascinated. But then I wrote, but then came Ethereum, far more than just a currency. It was designed to be a decentralized world computer. Suddenly the possibilities were endless. New apps could be written on top of Ethereum's code to solve countless world problems that had nothing to do with money at all. This invention completely blew my mind. It was my light bulb moment.
Yes.
And it was. That was when I got when Ethereum was invented, that's when I went, hold on, cryptocurrency is like the new internet. It's like the next big thing. I was watching this old clip of Bill Gates on David Letterman.
Divorce now.
Yes, I know. That makes me sad for some reason.
And me, I thought they were like the iconic happy couple, despite their billions and billions and trillions, they were just a happy couple. And even the statement they released was quite sad. They can no longer grow together as a couple. Basically, what that means is he wants sex, she doesn't.
You think? Is that what that?
So
is
he said, I got plenty of cash. I'm not a good-looking fella, but I can get it elsewhere. You know what I'm saying?
I suspect he can. I'm going to take a wild guess that he probably can.
I just think, it's quite sad.
27 years of marriage. It always saddens me when people have stuck it out for that long through the good and the bad, and then they jack it in after 27 years. It's sad.
Yeah, it is sad. Anyway, go on, sorry.
But anyway, there was a video clip. You can look it up for yourselves. It's on YouTube. I'll give you the name so that you can search for it. It is called What is Internet? Explained by Bill Gates, 1995. Okay. What is Internet? And basically, it's him on the David Letterman show.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah. And David Letterman didn't understand. He said, go on.
He goes, so what is this Internet thing? He's saying, like, what's the big deal? And then Bill Gates is going, well, you can send emails. You can look up information on any topic. You can do this and that. And everything he says, Letterman then comes back with, oh, so you're saying, basically, he says, you can watch your favorite baseball game. And he goes, what, you mean like I listen to it on the radio?
Yeah.
And he's going, yeah, but you can find out information about the baseball game.
He said,
I subscribe to magazines.
Yeah, and he said, you can watch it any time. He said, yeah, I got a tape recorder.
Yes, that's right, exactly.
So he didn't understand. You can understand that. It's not really a problem to be solved. But he said, hang on, it is actually, because taping it at a certain time is annoying and you won't listen back to it. Having it on catch-up and all that is just a lot easier, isn't it? And I suppose, it just makes it more smooth in operation,
It's like a labour-saving device in that sense. It's replaced dozens of other devices. But also, the point I was going to make quickly before you move on is just that there were... that at that point in time, all Bill Gates, even one of the cleverest men in the world, one of the most farsighted men in the world, even he could only imagine replacing things that we've already got. You know, you could watch your baseball game or whatever, but he couldn't envision all the brand new things that the internet has brought about, you know, things that we hadn't even considered in the past. And it's kind of the same with cryptocurrencies. At the moment, cryptocurrencies are replacing, or rather trying to replace, a lot of functions that already exist. But of course, there are many functions that they will be able to do that we haven't even conceived of yet. And that's the endless problem.
I mean, let's be honest, everyone thought, I remember the dot-com boom where companies on AIM would just change the name to dot-com at the end. They'd double overnight, you know, because everyone thought this is the new... I remember thinking at the time, though, but this is the way, you know, retail will go, this is the way commerce will go, you should do it online. And people said, well, you can't do things online, you can't, you know, you got to try clothes on and stuff like that. And in fact, some of those popular businesses, the best, most successful businesses, have been in the clothes game, like Boohoo and all that kind of stuff. They've done so well, ASOS, you know, they've done so well. So choose, you don't have to try them on, you just basically, you know, try them on, send them back, it works. And I suppose it's the same thing, but exactly, there's certain things we won't see that's going to change our lives for the better. But even down to, you know, trading, you know, you couldn't do that before the internet. You couldn't just. I had to call up Barclays and ask them to order some stock and get a quote and all that stuff. Now I just get the quote online. It's easy. And I would never want to go back. So I'm looking at the chart of Bitcoin. It doesn't look very good. Even the recent rally is like a head and shoulders pattern forming here. And even the recent, I'm looking at it right now, it's down below the 50-day moving average again. The RSI is still rolling over again. It looks like we could have a bit of weakness here. Do you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, well, when, you know, that's why the ETH BTC chart was so exciting to me, because you had a multi-year breakout. In other words, Ethereum had been underperforming relative to Bitcoin since 2018. And then suddenly, last week, it finally reaches back to the resistance line that it had started forming in 2018. And then just rocketed through it. And, you know, from a charting perspective, what that says to me is there's been a major turnaround in the perception of Ethereum relative to Bitcoin. And that's reflected in the fact that Ethereum against the dollar has been going up very fast, whereas, as you say, Bitcoin against the dollar is still struggling somewhat. You know, it's, well, let's see, it's hovering around the level that it was back in February still. So Bitcoin has gone nowhere since February, which, you know, in such a fast-moving market, is actually quite a long time that it's not done a lot. Now, you know, it may just be a breather. It's not. It's showing weakness, but it's not showing major weakness. As we speak, we're at $56,000, and the all-time high for Bitcoin was only 64,000 and something. So it's not that far away from the all-time high at the moment. So this may just be a breather for Bitcoin. Don't forget the Bitcoin, Ethereum, the ETH/BTC chart could still carry on rocketing if Bitcoin rises, as long as Ethereum is rising faster. Then the logic would mean they could both do well at the same time.
Yeah, but isn't that, I was thinking this, if a rollover happens in Bitcoin, doesn't that tend to affect all cryptos if it really does have a big rollover?
If it does a big one, yeah. If, say, I mean, looking at the chart at the moment, what we've got is a pattern, as I say, that goes back to February. And the support line, you know, the bit that you don't want it to go down below, at the moment is around about $47,000. As I say, we're at 56 at the moment. So it's got quite a lot of wiggle room. But if it does fall below its previous low at 47,000, then me and you and millions of other people will look at this chart and go, I really don't like the look of that. That will undermine the confidence of a lot of people. That's the psychological damage caused by breaking a support line. It tends to make a lot of people question their judgment of Bitcoin, their positive judgment. And so there will be some selling pressure. And if, if it goes significantly below 47,000, then we'll look at that chart and think it's a bit of a car crash. And that will be quite scary, not just for Bitcoin investors, but for a lot of other crypto investors. So they all start panicking and they all start selling. That's the way it usually works anyway, isn't it? And likewise, Ethereum, despite its incredible momentum at the moment, I wouldn't expect it to be immune to a big, proper Bitcoin sell-off. Because Bitcoin's still the daddy.
Yeah, I was looking... 47% dominance, they're saying, on the thing. On 46.2%, actually. Ethereum's now 17%. So, it's growing. Marvellous. I'm only dabbling around, but I want to see a big sell-off before I get involved properly and hold, you know. I just don't feel. I feel we need a big sell-off here. I can't buy at this level. It's ridiculous. Fear of missing out is kicking in, but I can't really go big at this level. I don't really want to go big, but I want to holding in something for the future. I think Ethereum's the one I want to hold, but I just want to see a big sell-off because I can't buy it. It's nuts, the charts. It's like they are really of Ethereum. Again, that's, you know, look at the relative strength. It's at 80. You know, you should never buy a, you know, 80 ever, because the probability of a consolidation is quite high at that level, or fallback.
I know, it really is. That's the problem, is that for anyone who hasn't already bought, you know, that's why I buy breakouts, and, you know, I buy at specific technical levels, because the problem is if you chase a breakout, like buying Ethereum right now, for example, would be chasing the breakout. Yeah, you might get more upside, but like you say, there's always a massive chance of a retracement.
Yeah,
because there usually is, isn't there? After you've had a big vertical rise in any chart, we all know that there's a damn good chance that it's going to just shoot back downwards, maybe not the whole way, but at least some of the way, because that's just what happens most of the time. So it's a scary time to try and be buying Ethereum. Sorry, I just noticed one quick thing on the dominance chart that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Bitcoin dominance, as you say, is down now to 47%. So that means that of the entire crypto sector, Bitcoin now only makes up 47% of the market cap, as opposed to only a few weeks ago when it was making up 73%. Yeah. So if that's all down, well, that's partly down to Ethereum, obviously, suddenly becoming much more important. But also,
that's interesting, actually. Go on.
I was just going to say dominance. The same thing happened in 2017 and late 2017 when we had our previous Bitcoin boom. Dominance fell enormously as other cryptos were catching up. And it actually peaked, or troughed rather. Bitcoin dominance troughed at 35%, right? That was the peak of the market. And as I say, we've now fallen to 47%. So we're actually not that far away from the dominance peak of the dominance trough, rather, of the previous market, which is kind of a bit worrying, maybe. Does it mean that we're reaching another peak? Or is it a sign, at least?
I think it is. If you look at, I mean, and also what's very interesting, actually, because I think now that, you know, you've got these big funds, in fact, it's a nice segue to your next bit of news, but you've got these funds that are, you know, getting exposure to Bitcoin. They will now, obviously, I assume, be looking at other cryptos as well, you know, and next in line, of course, is Ethereum. And when that's rising to all-time high and it starts to outperform Bitcoin on a percentage level, then the money will flow into that. And that I assume will take away from the strength of Bitcoin, and so make compound Bitcoin sell off. You know, so it's very interesting. If you look at the chart, monthly chart on Bitcoin, right, it doesn't look very good, because it's had now two monthly downturns, and that's never happened before. And the RSI is ticking over from up. It's up on the monthly chart, it's up at 890. Now it's down to 84. Whenever that's happened before, the last time this happened was basically back in 2017, when it had that 2-year sell off, pretty much from consolidation. So I think it's going to have it. We may take a bit of time, but you know, I think it's going to roll over. We've been saying this for ages. Of course, the rallies in bear markets can be very aggressive, so you may not think it's a sell-off. But then the fact that it's not attaining a new high on the next rally is a bearish sign, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm just looking at that. What you just said, it's the monthly candle that we've just had doesn't look anywhere near as bad as the one at the end of 2017. It looks to me more like one of the ones we got in, because there were some vicious downturns during the major upturn in 2017. You know, there were some 36% declines just along the way up during 2017. That's how volatile Bitcoin is. And the candle that we've just seen for April on the chart is kind of similar to the one we saw in September 2017. So we might not be at the top, but I guess it's a sign that the market is starting to get ants in its pants.
Ants in its pants?
Does that make sense?
No, it doesn't make sense at all.
Ants. What does ants in its pants mean again? It's kind of like,
but itchy.
Yeah. You know, well, I guess that's what I'm trying to say, isn't it?
You can't stop moving. You know, kids have ants in their pants. They're very. My son, my younger son, is like that. He cannot stop shifting and what's the word? Fidgeting. So anyway, listen. You talk about Ruffer. They're selling
ants. Yes, Ruffer. Yes.
Who are Ruffer? What are they doing?
Ruffer are described by the Daily Mail as a conservative asset management firm, which is a fair description because, you know, they're relatively sensible. They're not some crazy hedge fund. And they surprised the markets in November by putting 2.5% of their customers' money, about $600 million worth at the time, into Bitcoin. Mm. And they've made a tremendous amount since then because the price of Bitcoin is, what, 15 about... more than tripled since they bought. Mm-hmm. But what they've done now has worried a lot of people. They've cashed in. So they've still got some of their money left there, but they've cashed in a lot of their profits and left themselves with just their original investment. So they've taken about two-thirds of the position, I guess, or three-quarters even, which is kind of worrying in a way because, you know, the whole point about the whole narrative about institutional investment into Bitcoin is that it's supposed to be a long-term thing. That's what all the Bitcoiners say, the people who are obsessed with it. They just go, oh, look at all the institutions. They're in for the long haul. You know, Elon Musk, he's in it for the long haul. And me and you have expressed skepticism about that before, saying I bet Elon would sell his holdings as soon as the price starts looking a bit dodgy, you know. And sure enough, Tesla has already sold 10% of its position. Ruffer has now sold most of its position. It makes you think, yeah, are they really Bitcoin believers? I don't think so. I don't think any of these institutions are Bitcoin believers. They want to make money. That's their business, is making profit.
Well, there's this fear of missing out, right? And there's also fear of losing a profit. And when you're sitting on a big profit and you start having a bit of a wobble, starts getting a bit of ants in his pants at the top of the market, then you get these funds and hang on a sec, we've made a chunk load on this. We're not, you know, we're going to take our profit right now. We you know, because let's be honest, it's easier, and we all know this, easy percentage terms to go from like, 25,000 or 30,000 to 60,000 than it is to get to 100,000 or 25,000 to 50,000 rather than get 50,000 to 100,000. So has the big, fast, easy money been made? Yes. Of course it has. Yeah, way back. In fact, the big, fast, easy money was when people were buying it below $10,000, way below that, you know, even $1,000. That was fast, easy money. Now it's going to get harder the bigger market cap gets when there's more dominance, or its dominance is being chipped away at by Ethereum. Of course it is. So, yeah, of course they're going to take a profit. That's their game, isn't it? They're in this game for profit. They're not in it for loyalty. They don't care. Ruffers understand and say, we are hodlers. We are hodlers. We don't care. They're not going to say that. No, they're in it for profit. That's all. So they have to take their profit.
They have to at some point. Exactly. They're not going to just stay in through an 80% decline. You know, we saw an 80% or thereabouts decline in Bitcoin and greater, more like 85% for crypto as a whole. This is in 2018, 2019. You know, next time when this bull market ends and you enter... I assume another 80% decline probably. Is that are they going to sit through that? It seems highly unlikely that they would do such a thing.
Dan, I know what we do every week. Every week we speak to each other. We're going to do a Bitcoin and Ethereum target price for next week. Okay.
So I don't do price predictions. No, because I know. I'm a trend follower.
No, I know. Just for the podcast, for the fun.
No,
I'll do it, and you do it.
You can do it if you want. I ain't going to do it. I don't do price.
It's for ever. Fun. Listen, we'll all die soon. It's only a bit of fun.
It's my calling card is that price predictions are for fools and charlatans. Well, that's what I believe in my heart.
Glenn, you have an opportunity to prove your theory right now. You can say it's ridiculous because you say I'll try and predict the price. I guarantee I'll be wildly out because you can't do it. So let's do it then.
Give me a break. That's just as bad. Lose-lose for me. I end up looking stupid either way. Look, I've got another quick bit of news because we've only got a couple of minutes and I've forgotten.
Well, I'm
going to
give you prices for Bitcoin, Ethereum, okay?
I'm going to say
Bitcoin. This would be, I'd say below 50,000 this time next week. Let me just put that in there. Do you think it'd be above or below 50,000?
I'm not doing it.
Ben, okay.
I've got a story for you, which is interesting, and you're wasting your time on what I believe to be a totally pointless activity. Well, I don't believe anybody can predict prices.
I'm writing this down for me, and I think Ethereum, where is it? Let's look where it is. It's now about 33.42. I'm going to say 28. 28 is going to be... no, I'm going to say it's below 3,000. Below 3,000.
You see, this is interesting. This is why I don't often trade options, because options have an expiry date, right? So you have to basically take a position where you say, I think that the price will be above the level that it currently is this time next week. And that's what I refuse to do, because that's the problem. That kind of timing is impossible. Okay. So I do believe when you're in a trend, you can follow that trend like I am with Ethereum. Okay. So it's like, it's going up, so I buy it and it continues to go up. But I don't believe that I can ever say where it will be at a particular point in time. Okay. I don't think anybody can do that.
Well, I'm writing down Glenn's predictions. I'm saying Justin's below 50K.
I don't have none predictions.
Are you saying, are you going with me? Do you reckon... Bitcoin below 50 next week.
I just said I can't put date. I've just explained. I can't put dates on these things.
I'll put
things.
You down for above 50.
Don't put me down. Don't put me down.
Just have a go. This is us proving your theory. I believe it's impossible to guess. I believe that too. I'm with you.
You're not proving anything because I'm just data points.
It's like trying to guess a horse in a race.
You could be right. You could be wrong.
It's gambling. It's gambling, but we're not putting money down. It's basically trying to guess the winning horse.
I want everyone to know I ain't doing this. If he writes something down for me, I do not agree to that. Anyway,
so boring.
Can I just quickly tell you about Hyperfund? Just boring. Very, very quickly, because I know you've got to go. Hyperfund. Somebody wrote to me the other day, yesterday, in fact, saying, what do you think of this Hyperfund? Loads of people have sent me links to join Hyperfund. And basically, we're now at that stage of the market that we were in 2017, where a bunch of multi-level marketing schemes have come out for cryptocurrency. You remember we had things like BitConnect and famously OneCoin, the one that...
Good podcast on that. I was listening to it.
Yeah. And now there's Hyperfund, which... people are swearing blind they're making good money out of, but that's because, look, we can't say for sure it's a pyramid scheme. The problem with pyramid schemes is that it's very difficult to know for absolute certain that it's a pyramid scheme until the thing has imploded. So I can't say for sure that Hyperfund is a pyramid scheme, but it has so many of the features of a pyramid scheme. It's multi-level marketing, you know, people recommending it to their friends and sending links, referral links, affiliate links, right? You join and then more and more people join and more and more people join. The early people, including one guy who was writing on my Twitter yesterday, the early people can make some money out of it. So then that proves to the later people who get into it, oh, there is money to be made. You get daily payments or weekly payments or monthly payments. That's how these things always work. And then, you know, at some point, like all pyramid or Ponzi schemes, there comes a point where so many people are in it and there aren't enough new people to pay off the old people who've been in it. And then the whole thing collapses. Now, as I say, I can't say for definite that will happen to Hyperfund because I don't know. It's probably illegal is it defamation? I don't know. So I'm not going to say for definite. Yes. Stay away from this.
Okay,
it's terrible.
Glenn says Hyperfund is a scam. Okay, cool.
I have not said that. But there is a good website called Behind MLM where this guy does forensic investigations into multi-level marketing schemes, and he's done a review of Hyperfund, and he absolutely slammed it.
Do you know what? Trustpilot. It's on your Trustpilot. Read customer service reviews of Hyperfund.com. They've already scammed that as well because they've got a good rating. 35 reviews. Hyperfund. 4.3% out of 5.
What? Yeah, but because that'll all be people who are in it.
I know.
Trying to encourage other people to get in it and also being happy because they are genuinely getting payments. I've checked. Yeah. They can actually transfer their, which is unusual, they can actually transfer their money on the platform into real money. They can withdraw it. Now, that is unusual in itself because usually your money is kind of stuck there on the platform and the profits will build and build and you'll tell everyone how rich you are, but you can't actually withdraw any money ever from the platform. But in this case, at the moment, people are able to withdraw real money. So, you know, obviously that's very encouraging. And, you know, as I say, there's a possibility that this will turn out not to be a pyramid or a Ponzi and it really will turn into something decent. But I would put that on outside odds, put it that way.
Oh, there's a couple of people there who said it's a scam. said, this guy there says, he had money, put money in there, couldn't get money in, and he did. And they said, three times the money, pretty much. They're paying 0.5% interest per day. Then, so I tried to get the money out to my wallet. There's no support, and even though I opened a ticket, nothing has been done. Beware of this possible scam and check if you are unable or to withdraw money. Another person says, very obvious scam. It's only good until you want your money out. Do the maths. 0.5% daily compound is very unsustainable. They created a website in March 2021. So don't believe the stories and reviews from here saying they've been with the company for 2 years. Yeah, this is because some people are saying they've been here. Oh, what a blessing. I joined Hyperfund in December 2020. I joined with $300 and started receiving $1.50 a day. Now I'm up to $147 per day, growing in capitals. That's Lucy Floyd. Yeah, so that's odd. They only set the website in March, and yet people are saying it's a good review back in April. And in fact, updated on the 26th of April, 2 days ago. Yeah, so it's ridiculous. Yes, yes. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, where does the money come from?
It's the best decision ever made. Absolutely awesome business model. I see some people talk about it in a bad way, without even knowing what they're talking about. Support is second to none. Guys, just go there and enjoy what the company has to offer. This company is life-changing. Yeah, of course.
It's so depressing. It's the same rhetoric year after year, isn't it, for these kind of things? Yeah. You know, going back to the original Ponzi scheme in the 1920s, it's just people... I don't know. I just wish the word could be spread more.
Yeah,
I mean, I thought everyone knew what a pyramid scheme is, and yet people are still falling for them.
Yeah, people just want to make money the easy way. You can't make money the easy way. You have to do some research and do some work, put some work in. That's what people are scared of. Bit of hard work, bit of research. That's why you get dirty traders, Steve Glenn. They prefer to trade rather than research about a company and find out what the company's about. I'll just look at a chart. You know, easy.
That's not strictly fair, is it? I wrote a whole book about cryptocurrencies.
I'm not saying you.
I'm
not saying you, but some people are like that. They'll say they see the chart as the easy way, you know?
Oh, right. That was my guilty conscience then.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
You know what I'm saying? That most people try and look at a chart rather than actually learn about the business, learn about, you know, an income statement or balance sheets and cash flow statements and read the news the company's releasing rather than actually do that. They'd look at a chart and say, oh, yeah, it's a good buy.
Yeah, exactly. People should do both. A Hyperfund is a perfect example because even though it's promising to bring out various crypto-related products, those products don't exist yet. They're not, you know, they're not out. They're not doing anything. Whereas Ethereum is actually working in the real world. It underlies the entire industry of DeFi, for example.
Yeah,
so there are multi-billions of dollars being borrowed and lent, all based on the Ethereum blockchain.
Already?
Yeah, yeah, billions and billions.
Who's lending?
DeFi.
Who's doing that?
Individual people, small companies, little family offices.
Okay.
Well, little family offices. Some of them are very rich, aren't they?
When you say little family, do you mean the family little people?
Yeah, that's right.
That's why they go to a little family office. They all fit into it. It's
offices.
Like a hamster's. It's small, yeah. Little. Okay, I think on that note, we'll knock it on the head. Marvellous, Glenn. Speak next week. So I've got you for above 50K on BTC.
No, I never said that.
And above 3K
on
ETH. Thanks, Glenn. Speak you next weeky.
All right, bye.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They're at five. Location Sciences Group, down 6.25% to 0.525. Good support there, though, because the fundraise at 0.2. It was at 0.6, massive discount. There'd be some buying there, of course. At 4, Helium 1, 17.7% up, 23.95. Good rise that's been. At 3, Microsoft Systems, 4.35% up, 0.24 pence. At 2, Valerium Blockchain. It's got Ethereum, isn't it, in there, isn't it? Val, I see. Value Ethereum, I got it. It's down 4% to 35.5. And at 1... Sirius Mineral Resources, up 50% to 25.5. Okay, it's time for top five most read RNSs, and they are as follows. At 5, Braveheart Investment Group, further update, Paritic Limited. At 4, Codal Minerals, mining license update, a Begoni lithium product. At 3, Gritland Gold, appointment of broker and financial advisor. At 2, Novasite. Donates 1 million COVID-19 tests to UNICEF. And at 1, Argo Blockchain April operational update. Most liked are United Oil and Gas, Argo, Tirupati Graphite, and Codal Minerals and Microsec Systems. Okay, that's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciate.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.